Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University, and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CLXVII, The Gothic Invasion. This is the era of Roman history where the Goths from the north begin to pose a serious threat to the stability of the faltering Roman Empire. When they begin to lay siege to Roman cities, Decius rides to confront them, not realizing the challenging battles that await him. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
The Goths in the mid-3rd century are a Germanic people. At the moment, they're living in quite a large area which covers modern-day Romania and the Ukraine. They probably migrated from modern-day Poland towards the end of the 2nd century AD. It's thought, or it is said, and for this we depend on a 6th century writer named Jordanes, that they may have originally come from Scandinavia, but this is hotly disputed whether that's accurate. So they occupy a wide range of territory north of the Danube, so north of most of Rome's empire. It's only Dacia, which was conquered by Trajan, that actually extends to the northern bank of the Danube. Now, the name Goths probably just means the people in the Gothic language. You may have heard of the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths when people talk about the barbarian migrations of the later Roman Empire. They just mean the Eastern Goths and the Western Goths. It's not thought that the Goths were divided into those two groups at this period in the mid-3rd century. But I have to say, almost everything about Gothic history is controversial.
And is it one of those things where we know about the Goths pretty much only through sources that are talking about Romans?
Yes. I mean, most of our written sources are going to be Dexippus, a Greek writing in the late 3rd century. He is a Roman citizen. Jordanes, who writes in the 6th century, is an official and intellectual in the Eastern Roman Empire. He is of Gothic descent himself. There is a Gothic language which is attested, both a spoken and written form, and there is a Gothic Bible which survives from late antiquity when they become Christian. But at this point, we're really solely depending on our written Roman sources.
So what was the Roman interaction with the Goths then before this point? What did they know of them? What did they think of them? Is it a territory they were interested in conquering, or did they just more or less leave them to their own devices?
I think leave them to their own devices was the modus operandi for most of the time. There's no sense in the 3rd century that they want to expand further beyond the Danube, beyond what Trajan has conquered there. When they talk about the Goths, they call them Scythians. So when Dexippus writes his history of the Gothic War, it is the Scythica. And this is because this is the name that Greek historians, particularly Herodotus, used to describe the peoples who lived in the same area, so Romania and the southern Ukraine. So the Romans used the same term. Our histories are what we call classicizing histories, and that they want to be seen to be writing in the same style and continuing the great Greek historians of the past, such as Herodotus and Thucydides. But it also shows that their ethnographic knowledge was not the best. They just considered them the same people that Herodotus had described many hundred years before this. The Goths had served in the Roman army up to this point. They're first attested in the reign of Septimius Severus. We're not sure if they're sort of full auxiliary units or if they're individuals, but there are Gothic names appearing on inscriptions. And Shapur's account of the Persian campaign of Gordon III says his army was made up of Germans and Goths. Whether, again, that's sort of a whole units or smaller auxiliary groupings is not sure. There was a raid into Roman territory in 238. So the city of Istria in Moesia Inferior on the coast of the Black Sea was attacked by the Goths. They were paid to go away, which was, again, the Roman modus operandi, but it may also have meant that some of them entered Roman service at that time and later served in Gordian III's army.
Okay, and in the context of this roving band of Goths that we're going to discuss now, they've been hanging around slash causing trouble for the Romans, it seems, since the end of Philip's reign. So what is it that they were after at this point? What did they want from the Romans?
Yes, so we have to reconstruct their ambitions from the Roman sources and the archaeological evidence. We don't have their own account, but it seems at this point they're not after territory. So this is quite different than what you may have read about the barbarian migrations in late antiquity. So they're not looking to settle in Roman territory at this point. And we know this from their behaviour, which is mainly restricted to sacking cities, capturing Romans to service slaves, as well as taking back precious metal objects such as gold coinage, which then become prestige objects in Gothic society.
So I guess when you say archaeological evidence, it's Roman items, I guess, that are scattered around Gothic territory now.
That's right. So sort of the area of modern day Romania and the Ukraine, we find already that has been cut into many different pieces, perhaps to serve as some sort of currency, but also you find already so Roman gold coins, which have had holes made in them, so they can serve as jewellery.
So it's not about territory, it's more about getting some wealth and grabbing some booty and some slaves in the process. So it's around this time that they're going to start laying siege to Roman cities that are close to their territory. So is this a change in tactics for them?
Well, they did try and lay siege to Istria in 238, and that's really sort of the first major attack on a Roman city that we know of. And the fact that they were given money to go away suggests that, you know, this is their aim to acquire wealth. But one thing we do see in the reign of Decius is we see an unprecedented coordinated attack with multiple groups of Goths, and they're also allying with the Carpi, who had caused problems in the reign of Philip as well. And all this is being orchestrated by the Gothic king, King Cniva, C-N-I-V-A, who enters the scene at this point. They have a good, strong leader who has set his sights on Roman territory.
I gather we don't know a lot about Cniva, but is he a king in the sense of Romans have an emperor, or is he a chief who has managed to unite these Gothic tribes?
They do call him a king in our Roman sources, but we are depending on the Roman sources here. But there are other Gothic leaders mentioned. There is a fellow known as Ostrogotha, who appears in Jordanes as well as in Dexippus. It's interesting that Jordanes and his work, his Getica, his account of the Goths, has been known for a long time, and scholars didn't used to believe that Ostrogotha was a real person of the 3rd century. They thought he was sort of made up and retrojected back from knowledge in late antiquity. However, new fragments of Dexippus have come to light in recent years. They were discovered in the Austrian National Library in Vienna and published by two excellent scholars, Jana Gruskova and Gunther Martin. And the new fragments show that Ostrogotha was a real person and that he was a Gothic leader, probably subservient or sort of under Cniva. We're not quite sure. Cniva is definitely referred to as the king, and Ostrogotha is a leader. Whether there was rivalry between them, we don't know. So it's actually quite a complicated political situation.
Putting all that aside, though, Cniva seems to have been able to unite them and coordinate them in a way that they weren't doing before. So what does he do in Roman territory now? What is his target.
He puts together this alliance both of Goths and the Carpi to make this coordinated attack, probably in the spring of 250. Of course, this is the Northern Hemisphere spring, so this is the first half of the year. And the Carpi raid the province of Dacia, so they stick to the northern bank of the Danube. But then the Goths cross the Danube into Roman territory, firstly into the province of Moesia Inferior, and then further into Thrace. They divide themselves into two groups. The first group, possibly under the leadership of Ostrogotha, heads eastwards towards the part of Moesia close to the Black Sea. And they besiege the city of Marcianopolis. They fail to take the city. Dexippus tells us that this was because of the efforts of a local leader called Maximus. So he manages to beat off those Gothic forces there. But they don't go back to Gothic territory. They stay in Roman territory. This is the issue, is that, yes, the siege may fail, but they don't go away. So they're going to be in Roman territory throughout the rest of 250 and into 251.
So did this get a coordinated Roman response from the province then?
Yes. So the second group, which is under the command of King Niva, moves into the western part of Moesia Inferior, and they are noticed by the governor, Gaius Vibius Triboniarnus Gallus, who is a very important figure. Now, Dexippus tells us that the Gothic forces were about 70,000 under Niva, which is a huge force. Most of Dexippus's numbers, like those throughout ancient historiography, are probably inflated. Numbers of Roman forces, which we will meet later, are almost certainly inflated. But it's a substantial force there. So Marcianopolis has been able to defeat the Goths, or at least move them away from the city themselves. In the west, Triboniarnus Gallus and his forces managed to defeat Niva around the city of Novi, which is on the banks of the Danube there. But it's very important to mention here that the Goths don't go away. They're still in Moesia. So this prompts Decius, the emperor, to leave Rome. You know, this is the expectation in the 3rd century, or really since the time of Marcus Aurelius and the Marcomannic Wars, that emperors must campaign in person. So Decius sets out along with his eldest son, Herennius Etruscus, who is made Caesar, his wife, Herennia Etruscilla, and their youngest son, Hostilianus, are left in Rome. So Decius heads off, but his first target is actually not Moesia, it's actually Dacia, where the Carpi are ravaging the Roman territory. So he expels the Carpi from Dacia and then presses on south into Moesia Inferior, where he manages to defeat the Goths at a major battle at Nicopolis. And we're told here by Dexippus that 30,000 Goths died in this battle.
Oh, so about half the troops, if we're to believe any of the numbers?
Yeah, about half the size of King Niva's forces. But this is the key thing. Once again, he doesn't go away. He doesn't retreat back across the Danube. So you have Niva still in Moesia, and you have the other band, probably under the command of Ostrogotha, still there as well.
You've got to wonder what he knows that the Romans don't. So does Decius take any honours for this victory?
Probably not, actually. There is, on two milestones from Spain, the title of Dacicus Maximus, which suggests that he may have, or people thought, that he was awarded honours for removing the Carpi from Dacia. But there's no title such as Gothicus Maximus or anything like that awarded to him.
Feels like a bit of a missed opportunity there.
Well, yes, yes, exactly. You win a victory. Maybe he was waiting until the final expulsion of the Goths. He didn't want to count his chickens before they hatched.
So what does Caniva do next then? because you said he doesn't leave the territory.
No, he actually heads further south into Roman territory. So his aim, we're told, is to take the city of Philippopolis in the Roman province of Thrace. It's the northern part of the province. It's the province's largest city. This is modern-day Plovdiv in Bulgaria. So if you're following on a map, we're now in Bulgaria. And this requires Neva to cross the Hymas Mountains. We now call them the Balkan Mountains. It's a range which extends across from the Black Sea through Bulgaria all the way over to Serbia. So Neva is pushing southwards, and Decius and his forces follow the Goths. Now, we're told that the Gothic forces actually surprise the Romans in an ambush. Dexippus actually tells us that the Roman scouts betrayed them. They were obviously led into a difficult situation. So battle is joined at the town or the city of Beroia, which is known as Augusta Traiana to the Romans. And this is a major loss for the Romans. It's a resounding defeat, which means that Neva can press on southwards into Thrace, and Decius actually retreats back to Novi, the legionary camp and city on the Danube.
All right, so that essentially leaves Philippopolis a bit open for attack and a siege, doesn't it?
Exactly, exactly. So this is what happened, for example, with Marcianopolis in Moesia Inferior. So we have a large fragment from Dexibuthus Scythica, which talks about how Decius tries to deal with the situation. Most of it is actually taken up with a letter which Decius is said to have sent to the people of Philippopolis. So the governor of Thrace, a man called Titus Iulius Priscus, according to Dexippus, summons the people of Philippopolis into the theater, where he will read out Decius's letter. Decius may very well have sent a letter to the people of Philippopolis, but as it survives in Dexippus, this is clearly a construction of the historian himself.
So when you say this letter likely isn't what Decius actually wrote, if he did indeed write a letter to Philippopolis, is it like a rhetoric exercise on the part of Dexippus, or is it, Dexippus, you need to write an essay and we need you to pretend that you're Decius writing to Philippopolis, give me 2,000 words. Is it that kind of exercise?
Mm. Ancient historians insert speeches into their histories in order to provide insight to the characters who are delivering the speeches, you know, what their thoughts, their fears, their feelings might be at a particular moment. And the letter is very much like this as well. We don't have a speech of Decius, we have a letter which is written like a speech. So it's supposed to shed light on how Dexippus interprets Decius's character, as well as showing off Dexippus's own skills as a writer.
Okay, but you're pretty certain that it's all made up?
It doesn't look like any other imperial letter. Other imperial letters are written in a very formal style. They have specifics in them. This has a lot of florid, what we call rhetorical commonplaces, which I'll talk about in a moment, which are found in other historiographical speeches. It reads very much in the vein of Herodotus and Thucydides rather than a genuine imperial letter.
Okay, so you've co-authored a paper on this letter.
Yes, I have, yes.
So take me through it. What does it tell us then about Decius, or what Dexippus wants us to know or think about Decius? Off you go.
Yeah, so at the beginning, there's a sort of preamble in which Dexippus said Decius feared, and I quote, there'd be some change concerning the stability of the empire. And what this seems to mean here is a worry that the people of Philippopolis looking for a defender will revolt and set up their own emperor, with the governor of Thrace, Priscus, being the most obvious candidate. And this is what we've seen several times already throughout the 3rd century, particularly in the Balkan Danubian region, is that the armies or the people will acclaim someone who is right there to be their emperor, to lead them. So the idea is, if the people of Philippopolis defeat the Goths themselves, they might say, hey, we don't need Decius. We've got this guy, Priscus. He'll be our champion there.
That's probably a good thing for Decius to put in the letter. But the downfall of that idea is that he's asking Priscus to read it out to them.
Yes.
So maybe Priscus just doesn't read out that bit.
Yes. Dexippus is also writing with the benefit of hindsight. He's writing in the 270s, so he's writing knowing that Priscus does actually revolt. Still, I think Dexippus has quite a good insight into the problems which are facing the empire at this point of time. The main point of the letter is that Decius wants the people of Philippopolis to be afraid of going into battle without him. He wants them to hold fast until his own forces arrive. And this is quite interesting because it seems that early in the year, the people of Marcianopolis did quite well without the Roman forces there. I mean, they didn't declare anyone an emperor, but there is certainly a precedent of locals succeeding. So Decius tries to reassure the people of Philippopolis that he and the legions will be there very soon. And he says, and I quote, "Preparations have been time-consuming for this expedition, since I have been occupied with both our recent victory as well as the rest of the war. And my guess is that the barbarians, given that they have been scattered so far afield, have arrived before we have and will attack you." Now, it's interesting here that he doesn't mention the recent defeat at Beria Augusta Traiana. He only mentions the victory at Nicopolis.
It was the victory and, quotation, the rest of the war.
Yes, the rest of the war. And that, of course, is what has left Philippopolis open to the Goths there as well. So Decius goes on to say, you know, don't do it yourself. You know, this is not a time to fight them alone. And I'll quote again, "For I am told that, somewhat intemperately emboldened by your numbers and exuberance, you hope thereby to inflict a stunning reversal upon the enemy. A typical mistake made by those inexperienced in war, whose understanding is remarkable more for its daring than for its foresight, given the absence of any prior encounters." So, you know, he's saying, don't rush out, don't be too overly enthusiastic, you'll end up in trouble. This is a rhetorical commonplace we find in many ancient war narratives. He then goes on to say, you know, don't try and fight the Goths because they're too frightening. And I quote, "Furthermore, the enemy has a fearsome amount of military expertise and inspires dread thanks to their physical appearance and their habit of banging their arms, and is more than capable of scaring the living daylights out of those who meet them in battle for the first time with their extravagant yelling and screaming." They're just too awful. Where Romans, you know, we'll fight in orderly fashion, but if you go out and meet the Goths, they're going to scare you. He goes on to say, "We're on our way. Wait for me. I'm coming." He says, "It's safer to be led by a commander and to face the danger allied to others both in planning and action, since the presence of an ally makes it all the easier to make the right decisions. We have abandoned neither preparation nor planning for the saving of your community, and you may expect our arrival in a few days with a force." So the emphasis here is Decius saying, I'm a great commander, I've got the experience, you're inexperienced, so don't do this. But behind all this, Dexippus is saying there's a fear that if they do succeed against the Goths under Priscus's leadership, they will declare Priscus emperor.
It's a very interesting letter. It's not exactly trying to reassure Philippopolis that they're safe and that Decius is going to protect them. He said that they're going to be there soon, but it seems more that Decius is worried that Philippopolis will decide that they don't need him.
Mm, mm. He's acknowledging that the Goths will be there before he will be. So he's saying, you know, hold out until we arrive. And this is why we, co-author Christopher Mallon and I, think that this is a construction which sort of sheds light on the problems of politics and warfare in the 3rd century AD. It's about competition between emperors and other commanders. It's about locals who are going to try and take matters into their own hands. And if they do well, might say, well, we don't need you as an emperor. We have our own emperor here. And this is quite a significant shift in thinking compared to, say, for example, the Roman world in the 1st century AD.
All right, then, so what happened? Philippopolis is kind of left to its own devices for a few days. Decius is on his way, but he's not going to get there in time.
Dexippus' account cuts off at this point, the surviving fragment we have. So we depend here on Giordanes Getica, when we see that the people of Thrace make Priscus emperor, but then Priscus betrays Rome, essentially, by joining an alliance with the Goths. He lets them into Philippopolis, but then they sack the city, which is presumably not what he wanted them to do. And at some point, Priscus himself is also killed. It's a major disaster. It doesn't go the way Decius wanted, but it also doesn't go the way Priscus wanted. And there's quite a lot of suggestions in Giordanes, and we'll see this again with Trebonianus Gallus, that there is some collusion between the Goths and people on the Roman side. Now, the fall of Philippopolis is a major crisis, especially for those living further south, the people of Greece. And we know from a new fragment of Dexippus that was discovered in Vienna, the different representatives from the Greek states gathered and made preparations to defend Greece at key locations, including blocking the pass at Thermopylae, which of course is what the Greeks did during the Persian Wars. So we can see from these new fragments of Dexippus the panic that the fall of Philippopolis caused.
And in the meantime, you've got Decius, I guess, scrambling to consolidate some sort of troop resistance and go there and confront them?
Yes. I mean, he's still up at Novi, which is on the Danube. He'll be there with Trebonianus Gallus, the governor of Moesia Inferior. But essentially, the Goths have been left to make their way through Roman territory, looting and pillaging, capturing people, enslaving them, until Decius and the Romans can regroup and do something about it.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, Decius will ride north to see the Goths out of his territory, and as thanks, he'll become the first Roman emperor to fall in battle against a foreign enemy. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.